Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we're watching, reading, and listening to. On this week's show, we'll talk about the new FX series, The Comedians, starring Billy Crystal and Josh Gad, and its relatives in the broader family of show business stories and backstage satire. Then we'll take a look at that briefest of acting triumphs, the cameo. From football players who were a little wooden to politicians who should have stayed in their offices, what cameos are and how they work. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. So stick around. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. For music games, puzzles, and trivia of all sorts right now, check out Ask Me Another. Can you do math at the movies or name commercial jingles sung in Italian? Care to moonwalk with Asif Manvi from The Daily Show? Ask Me Another is like trivia night, but a lot funnier. Play along now at npr.org/podcasts. This week's show is full of Hollywood talk, but before we get to that, let's meet the panel this week in historic Studio 44. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. With me is Stephen Thompson. Stephen, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And with us this week is Chris Klimek. Chris, when you're not talking comedy and cameos with us, what do you do?
I am an editor at Air and Space Smithsonian Magazine and an occasional Monkey See contributor.
Well, it's always wonderful to have Chris with us. FX has been lucky with some of its comedy offerings in the last several years. They built devoted audiences for It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, for The League, You're the Worst, and of course, Louie, which returned this week. And with the new season of Louis C.K.'s Emmy-winning comedy, they've paired a new show called The Comedians, starring Billy Crystal and Josh Gad. It gets a little confusing. It gets a little bit thick on the ground. It is structured as a faux documentary about Crystal and Gad being forced to work together to make a sketch show for FX. So they're both playing bizarro versions of themselves in the tradition of people like Neil Patrick Harris in the Harold and Kumar movies, or Will Wheaton on The Big Bang Theory, or any number of other examples that we've known across time. So I'm going to start, I think, with Glenn. How did this show strike you, Glenn?
I like the bones of this show. I saw about the first five or six episodes, and I'm in for the long haul. I'm curious about where it's going. It has the you can feel the influence of shows like Extras, of shows like The Comeback.
Certainly The Comeback, I think.
Yeah, I explain it to people as it's The Comeback if The Comeback had no gay people involved at all. It's The Comeback without any kind of gay sensibility.
Interesting.
And a slight bit of gay panic.
A little bit of gay panic, but I mean, you know, within normal parameters, I suppose. The one that it really reminds me of is The Larry Sanders Show. Mm-hmm. It differs in a small but crucial way, both The Larry Sanders Show and The Comeback. Gary Shandling was playing a character. Lisa Kudrow was playing a character. So when they kind of turned the spotlight on themselves, they could be as lacerating with themselves as they were with everybody else. Here, Billy Crystal kind of gets off light.
Mm-hmm.
He is an executive producer. He's a writer of the pilot. You kind of want that 360 kind of laceration.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What I like to see him in is now he's doing dry again. And he used to do that when he was just starting up in his career. He went through this period. We can talk about it a little bit where he got a little bit broader, stickier, schmaltzier. And I like seeing him in this mode better than other modes I've seen him in. But I really wanted it to be a little more, have a little less self-indulgence on his part.
Yeah, it sounded, Stephen, like you were agreeing with that.
Yeah, I actually wrote down many of the same things that you just said in my notes here. I think the blessing and the curse of Billy Crystal, and I'm speaking of Billy Crystal, the Billy Crystal persona, not just his character on this show, is that he is always trying to entertain you.
Yeah.
And he's always trying to entertain you very sincerely. It's not a put-on. He's an awards show host. He's Mike Wazowski in Monsters, Inc.
He's a game guy, yeah.
And so what makes that a curse is that when he's trying to present a version of himself that is maybe falling out of touch, he's still trying to sell it in a way that makes it hard to tell the degree to which he's in any way being commented upon. And I think that contributes to what I agree is the biggest problem with the show, which I like, which I'm enjoying the show. There are some good jokes in it. The joke density is not super high, but it's there. Mm-hmm. To back up on the premise of the show a little bit, it's a sketch comedy show. It's supposed to originally be a Billy Crystal only vehicle. It's supposed to be called Billy and Billy, and it's just him playing every character. Mm-hmm. And the network, FX, has decided to pair him with Josh Gad, a younger, somewhat of a younger version of Billy Crystal, another very game, but much younger, different comedy sensibility. And you have those two generations knocking against each other. The Josh Gad character is more of he's a schlemiel. Mm-hmm. You know, he is constantly knocking into things and constantly screwing things up.
There's a scene in the pilot where a woman mistakes him for Jonah Hill, I think, or she says, I loved you in The Wolf of Wall Street. And that is kind of his persona.
Yeah, and I felt like the Josh Gad character, in part because he is the creator of so much of the chaos, because he's the person who goes around screwing things up, it feels like he's commented on more. Mm-hmm. I'm 3.5 episodes in, and there's a bunch of stuff where he's playing off the fact that he's one of the voices in Frozen, mm-hmm. and that's one of his big successes. That's being heavily cracked on and commented on, and his relation to that is puffed up. You see where that intersects with his ego in goofy ways. He is commented on so much more richly than I think Billy Crystal is commented upon. Billy Crystal is ironically made to be almost a straight man.
That's where it falls down for me.
That's a good point. How about you, Chris?
You know, this might be coming from the fact that I worked as a personal assistant in Hollywood for about a year. So, I mean, some of this stuff feels kind of familiar. I was working for someone who was not nearly as famous as Billy Crystal, but at about the same point in their career, where there's another generation coming along, mm-hmm. and they have some feelings about that. I think it would be a more interesting conflict between Crystal and Gad if this sort of pseudo-Crystal was more inclined to be a little more magnanimous. The fact that he's been so successful, he's constantly in the show reeling off his achievements and his Emmys and his Tony and I mean, I get that, like every showbiz story, it's about how it's never enough. No level of recognition is enough. It's, you can never just gracefully exit when your time has passed. But the fact that they make him so competitive with Gad, at least in the early episodes, that seems like a more predictable choice to me a little bit than having him kind of react to Gad's ambition in a more generous, forgiving way.
Yeah, and I would say as the show goes on, there's a little bit more of that. I think part of what Glenn is getting at is something that struck me as a softening of the treatment of Billy Crystal as the show goes along. Mm-hmm. When the show first opened, some of my favorite jokes in the pilot are things where Josh Gad, who at that point has not been set up to be as much of a jerk as they're going to set him up, or such a, like a dummy, they're going to set him up to be later, is saying things like, when I found out that Billy Crystal wanted to work with me, nobody was more excited than my grandparents.
Good.
Yeah.
Which I think is an interesting little dig. And then the one I think is an even better version of essentially that same joke that happens very shortly thereafter is when he meets Billy Crystal and he says, I've seen all over Starz Family recently. that is an ouch, you know? And I think at that point when they are really more willing to play with the idea that Billy Crystal is not just past, the prime of his career, but making some things that aren't great,
right?
Yeah. Which is kind of what that Starz Family joke is about. Those movies that he's done that are kind of a little bit like, that nobody kind of wants to see you make.
I mean, it's weird that they would go there, though, because, I mean, Billy Crystal was deep into his career when he made Monsters, Inc. He didn't become a family movie guy until he had done a lot of other things, whereas Josh Gad is clearly most famous for Frozen, right?
But
for
I mean, a family. Frozen Slickers was definitely a family movie.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that I like that playing around with the Billy Crystal stuff, which I feel like over time the show becomes more openly in the pocket of Billy Crystal more than not. I think the show is funny.
Yeah. I
thought the jokes were, I was impressed despite the fact that there are things where they're holding back. I was impressed that they were talking about stuff like as raw and recent as there's a whole bunch of stuff about 1600 Penn, the show that Josh Gad was on NBC, which was a real show that died real fast and was real pilloried.
I like the fact that in Josh Gad's dressing room, there's a gigantic 1600 pen poster. Yep.
Well, and he has that moment where he talks about the money from the second season of 1600 pen, and his agent's like, there wasn't a second. He's like, I know. It's just it's a very odd little joke. My favorite joke, and this was where I thought, like, somebody here really is paying attention to very small details and sometimes is not going out of their way to comment upon them, is when they are talking about the way to shoot a scene and Josh Gad does not know the difference between a live audience and what he refers to as canned laughter. Mm-hmm. And that is something you see from self-indulgent young comedy people all the time, that they say, oh, all those shows that have canned laughter or a laugh track. Mm-hmm. And they'll say it about shows like The Big Bang Theory, for example. And those guys will come roaring back and say, it's a live audience. Like, you may like it and you may not like it,
right,
but you should know what you are talking about.
Right.
The fact that that went uncommented on is a really small joke. And I was very impressed to see it in there because somebody put that in there on purpose.
Yep. I did laugh a lot. The jokes land. Many of the jokes land. I am curious about the path of the show. I mean, we keep building on as the season progresses toward the time when the show actually premieres. And this raises the question that it always raises, like, is this show we're seeing bits of supposed to be any good?
Right.
And I have seen evidence, yes, and I've seen lots of evidence, no.
Yeah.
And so we know it's going to be part of the storyline, but exactly how it plays out, I'm in to see.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It's almost like there are more, you see more fake sketch comedy than you see sketch comedy
right.
anymore.
Right.
That, you know, you have 30 Rock where they swap in scenes from what is clearly a bad sketch comedy show. With this, it's a little tricky to tell what you're supposed to think about it.
Yeah.
But the cameos, I mean, like, we're going to talk about cameos in a second, but I mean, it's great to see Danny Delaney. It's always great to see Dennis O'Hare. Stephen Weber it's really more a guest appearance, and it made me so nervous.
What you learn in the pilot, Billy Crystal in particular wants to work with a character played by Stephen Weber, who you see a picture of, who was a director that Billy Crystal had worked with in the past. And when this character shows up, it turns out that she's a transgender woman who Billy Crystal knew prior to when she came out, so knew when she identified as a man. And my reaction when I looked at that was, why?
Right.
Like, why are you doing this? Like, I'm not saying, like, you need a special justification or it has to be about the fact that she's trans in order for her to be a good character to include. But if you're not going to do anything about it except, like, I hate it when people include transgender characters for that oh God moment.
Yeah.
For, like, that moment when everybody goes, oh my God,
yep.
she's a woman, you know? That I don't like if you don't go anywhere with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because
there's very little with that character
there
beyond.
There is.
What?
But that
there
sets
is.
Up the Stephanie Weir story, this woman who I don't understand. Is she a line producer on the Billy and Josh show?
She's supposed to be a producer.
She has to watch the money. You know, she gets the phone calls from FX. And she had an affair with
Jamie.
Okay, prior to her transition in the 90s, mm-hmm. and is very nervous about the prospect of thinking she thinks him again because she has been out of contact with mm-hmm. Jamie all this time. And Stephanie Weir is pretty much my favorite character on
Absolutely.
The show at this point. So the fact that this early in the show, we're giving her a major storyline, how she responds to this former lover of hers, that was in the plus column for me.
But I think there are lots of other ways to make it awkward to get together to see a former lover other than that, which to me has become kind of the most hacky. It's really funny because Stephen Weber was on Wings, mm-hmm. of course, and I found myself thinking, I think they did this story on Wings
one time.
That's been a while. I'm not sure if they actually did, but it is certainly something that they did on 90s sitcoms where it would be, at that time, it was talked about in very comical terms. But now you're in this situation where if it seems like the entire purpose of this person is for them to be a punchline, then all you're doing is setting yourself up to screw up.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
And speaking of the 90s, I mean, Stephanie Weir is a veteran, a battle-scarred veteran of Mad TV, that sort of catchphrase factory. And I had never really, she'd never really crossed my radar before, but she is so good here. Every time the camera gets off of Billy and Josh onto her, for her to do any piece of business, there's an extended monologue she has a little bit later on in the season where she's talking about, among other things, chicken shears. That moment is fantastic. She is just bringing the show alive for me.
Yeah. Steven, is it harder for you to key in to care about a show if it's about Hollywood as opposed to other things? I mean, we've certainly talked a lot about movies that are about the joy of movies. Mm-hmm. If a show is about characters who are involved in show business, do you think it's harder to kind of click into it and care about it?
There are so many shows about, you know, where like Larry David is peeling back the curtain behind what it's like to be Larry David. And
Right.
you sort of feel like, wow, I have no way into that other than this may channel some of my own misanthropy.
Sure, sure.
I think the key is just this sense that you're just seeing something you haven't seen before. You want to get a side of these actors or these characters' personas that you're not otherwise seeing. You
yeah.
know, and sometimes you get these portrayals that are designed to upend your expectations of these actors, whether it's like Neil Patrick Harris comes on yeah. and he's a giant misanthrope, or somebody comes in and, you know, they're supposed to, you think they're a nice person, but they act like a tyrant.
Right.
In this, I think part of where I had a little bit of an uneven reaction to the show is that they're upending a little bit of Josh Gad and not upending yeah. as much of Billy Crystal, and that imbalance is still throwing the show off for me.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, as much as it reinforces the notion that Hollywood people are vapid and, you know, shallow, that's great. What I would react to more strongly is the, what we've seen some, a little bit this year already, artists are the true heroes, and aren't they noble? Sort of the West Wing for Hollywood. That's or Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, which was exactly that. That's what rubs me the wrong way. This, and again, the fact that we are seeing a different side to both these people. Billy Crystal is many things. He's always big. He's always out there. Josh Gad is a little mini-me version of that. Both of them here, when they're interacting with each other, are doing it kind of dry, subtle, relatively subtle. It's smaller, and I like seeing them in that mode.
Cool. I enjoy this show enough that I will definitely keep watching it for a while. I don't know if I'll stick with it all the way through, but I enjoyed it. I'll be interested to hear what people think about it. Come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about cameo appearances, when they work, when they don't work, who's particularly good or not so good at offering them to shows. So we will be right back.
Hi, I'm Sarah, and I'm calling from Northeast Ohio. Thanks to our sponsor, Loot Crate. It's a monthly subscription box service for epic geek and gamer items and pop culture gear. Each month, Loot Crate will send you a box with 6 to 8 unique and one-of-a-kind items that include licensed gear, apparel, and collectibles. April's fantasy-themed Loot Crate will include items from your favorite fantasy franchises, including Game of Thrones, Harry Potter, and The Princess Bride. But you only have until April 19th at 9 p.m. Pacific to subscribe. Head to lootcrate.com/NPR and enter code NPR to save 10% on any new subscription. Thank you. Bye.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. The other thing we are going to talk about today is cameo appearances. Now, we talked a little bit about this when we talked about the comedians. And before we have this conversation, we should mention it's inevitable. A certain number of cameos are supposed to come as surprises, and we are likely to kind of give away nothing that I think qualifies as, nothing that I think is going to be devastating to anything that's out right now. I'll put it that way. But, you know, we're likely to hit a couple of spots, so just be aware of that. Now, one of the things that motivated us to have this conversation is yet another thing that arose from all of our viewings of Parks and Recreation. We will skip over too much of that, but Stephen was watching Parks and Rec and noticed that as the show goes on, particularly in the last couple seasons, there are a lot of political cameos. There's Biden stuff, there's, mm-hmm. you know. And so he had sort of mentioned that it got to the point where it seemed a little bit off.
Yeah, I mean, and it's funny because there are so many incredibly funny cameos in that seventh season. That Werner Herzog bit mm-hmm. is so great. The Genuine stuff is so funny. But every time they would trot out senators,
yeah.
it just landed with a plop.
Yeah.
You know, you're getting like the comedy stylings of Orrin Hatch. Yeah. You know who's hilarious? Barbara Boxer.
Yeah.
And they're just kind of like sitting at their desks like, well, Leslie, I think that, I'm like, wow, a chance to see John McCain on TV.
Yeah.
like
Orrin Hatch is a songwriter, too. I mean, let's give him his due.
As he is on Parks and Rec. I just, I don't want to see these people on my television.
Okay, so regardless of the applicability to that one particular show, which I want to move off of as quickly as possible.
Sure, of course,
I do want to ask, this is kind of a couple of organizing principle kinds of questions. What is the line between a cameo appearance and a small guest role? This is a kind of taxonomy sorting type thing, so I want to ask Glenn whether he has an opinion.
Well, back in the day, it was a special guest star X. So on I Love Lucy, it would be, but Ricky, I want to dance with Hollywood's Van Johnson.
Right.
Come in. Or, you know, Tinseltown's Charles Boyer, whatever.
Or Marcia Brady with Davy Jones.
Or Marcia Brady with Davy Jones. Now, those were relatively lengthy parts. I mean, the cameo originally meant sketch, and so I think it means short. Short is very important.
Yeah.
I also think it's very crucial for what we now consider to be the cameo, which is usually uncredited and usually has an air of knowingness about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It trades on, it gets its energy from our pre-existing, predispositioned, reflexive toward that person, not that character, not even that actor, but that persona, that person. We have a pre-existing idea of that person, and what they want us to do is to see that person and say, oh, that guy. Yay, that guy.
Right, or, oh, that's interesting, which is like, if you look at the Tom Cruise thing at the end of Tropic Thunder, it has that feeling of like, really?
Yeah.
Because it looks so different, and he's doing a very different thing than people are used to.
A variation of that is, oh, look who they got. Like, that's also a part of it. There are, I think genre films tend to do this better because they have a pre-existing fervent fan base for that particular thing. Odds are better that you're going to recognize somebody coming into this thing. Everybody in John Wick who makes a cameo appearance, you kind of want to see them in a movie like this.
Mm-hmm.
That's also another aspect to it.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to compare a true cameo, right, which is a person doing a small role, with the thing that's even smaller than that, which is the Stan Lee pop on the screen just for the sake of you see Stan Lee.
Just to get that awe.
Or Alfred Hitchcock,
who
walks through every Alfred Hitchcock movie but never says anything and doesn't have a part. You just see him if you know that you can look for Alfred Hitchcock in every Alfred Hitchcock movie.
Yeah, those performances are Those are basically Easter eggs.
Yeah.
They almost don't even count as cameos.
Peter Jackson, same thing.
Even though everybody knows to look for those in the Marvel movies now, to me, the part of the divider between a guest appearance and a cameo is surprise. You know, it's better if you don't know that it's coming.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
I like it when the cameo is kind of commenting on either the person doing the cameo or the project itself. There are several examples in pirate movies for some reason where, like, they would put David Crosby as just like one of the pirates in Hook because he looks kind of like a pirate.
Yeah.
Or Keith Richards in several of the Pirates of the Caribbean movies where, like, the Johnny Depp character is so clearly, like, modeled on Keith Richards in a way that it's a nice little surprise. I do think that element of surprise is nice, but when you put non-actors in cameos, I think it's a little dicier, and it's where you get things like Brett Favre lumbering onto the set to say, I came back for you, Mary. And, like, as you see his eyeballs tracking on the cue card.
I think in a comic context, you know, their woodenness can become part of the joke.
Sure.
You know, whereas in something like The Wire, where David Simon used all these non-actors in kind of minor roles, they would stick out like a sore thumb against the professional actors because the professional actors are all British, generally.
Yeah.
But you could really tell. And I know he's trying to contribute some authenticity, some atmosphere. I don't know if it always worked.
Yeah, I mean, there's something about that moment of seeing them, that moment of aha, which is what they want. They want that surprise. They want that moment. And then if they have to hang out much longer, Barbara Boxer, Joe Biden, and they don't really have much to do.
Yeah.
You want, if you're going to put somebody into a role like that, you want them to have something to take the film and continue the energy. Christopher Walken can be counted upon in cameo roles to do Christopher Walken big.
Right.
In both True Romance and Pulp Fiction, he's there. You kind of go, oh, it's him. And then you kind of sit back and wait for him to Christopher Walken the hell out of it.
Right.
But
right.
Yeah, like, as often if you can just give the person one line and have that line be a joke, it's different than having Barbara Boxer be like a setup person for someone else who's doing funny materials. I think about, like, Huey Lewis in Back to the Future. And it's Huey Lewis being a good sport in the movie. And it's just a fun little tweak, just a fun little joke for people who know that that's Huey Lewis.
Well, and I want to pick up on that briefly, the comment about being a good sport, I think, is often part of what makes a lot of these cameos, is the ability to look at people and say, oh, that is another place I would bring up the Tom Cruise Tropic Thunder thing. is it's just more of a sense of humor than people at that time thought that guy had.
Right. Bob Barker in,
I was just going to mention
in Happy Gilmore, for example. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just not something we'd ever seen Bob Barker do, I think it's safe to say.
Exactly.
And he did it great.
The price is wrong.
I think you've had enough. No? Now you've had enough.
Exactly.
Well, and every once in a while, you do give a non-actor an opportunity to stretch out and be funny. Like, everybody remembers in Wayne's World, which I recently rewatched, you've got that Alice Cooper bit, and everybody remembers, we're not worthy, we're not worthy. But Alice Cooper has this whole really funny riff about Milwaukee, you know, it's being Algonquin for the good land. Yeah. He's very funny in it, and yeah. It kind of gives you just another little dimension, somebody you thought you had understood.
Two things. First, are there actors who you would peg as the most reliable to show up in cameos, similar to Christopher Walken? Are there others?
I got one who definitely always makes a film better. Bill Murray in a cameo appearance.
Has done a lot of them.
Zombieland, when he's in it, he elevates that film because he is providing a counterpoint, which no other person could do for that film what Bill Murray does because of Bill Murray's innate Bill Murray-ness.
I'm sorry. I didn't know that it was you.
Are you? What's with the get-up?
Oh, I do it blend in. You know, zombies don't mess with other zombies. Buddy of mine, makeup guy, showed me how to do this. Cornstarch, you know, some berries, a little licorice for the ladies. It suits my lifestyle. You know, I like to get out and do stuff. Just played 9 holes at Riviera. Just walked on. Nobody there.
My other question would be, are there people, probably not actors, hopefully not actors, can you be so wooden that you can't even be trusted to say, like, one thing sitting behind a desk? Can kind of who you are always carry you through one line? I think Stephen in his head wants to go back to Brett Favre.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are certain non-actors who are just so bad at being naturalistic, like who don't go easily into pretend. And I think that's where you get a lot of, so many of the examples that are flooding my mind are of athletes.
Yeah.
And like, to me, I may have said this on the show before, but if somebody made a DVD of nothing but locally produced commercials featuring NFL players, I would pay $50 for it. I would so love to have Antonio Freeman of the Green Bay Packers holding up a Red Baron pizza, or like Gilbert Brown being propped up to talk about a Milwaukee law firm. I love that. I just eat that stuff up with a spoon. And I know that a lot of it is on YouTube, but it's not all there. Somehow, if you could scour...
You have very specific taste.
I think part of what makes them so bad when people can't act is because the appearance is so brief, you don't have time to adjust. I would submit to you that no one is so terrible an actor that you can't, after a few minutes, start to sort of correct for that in your mind. I've watched a lot of Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Uh-huh. It also, though, acting so often is a product of writing. And so part of what makes athletes especially wooden in commercials is that they're given these terrible scripts by local ad agencies. But there are definitely, Brett Favre is that perfect example. Like, Brett Favre is not a good actor.
Yeah.
He's not any kind of actor.
He's not any kind of actor, even to the point where
saying... Ben Stiller wouldn't throw football very well either.
No, absolutely not.
All right, well, I would be interested to hear about favorite and least favorite cameos, so hit us up. When we come back, we're going to talk about our favorite thing. What is making us happy this week? Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. For music games, puzzles, and trivia of all sorts right now, check out Ask Me Another. Can you do math at the movies or name commercial jingles sung in Italian? Care to moonwalk with Asif Mandvi from The Daily Show? Ask Me Another is like trivia night, but a lot funnier. Play along now at npr.org/podcasts. Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
A few weeks ago, my 11-year-old daughter came up to me and asked me if I had heard of a book called Roller Girl, a graphic novel about a fifth grader who takes an interest in roller derby and becomes a derby girl. And I said, Roller Girl? Why, yes, I do. In fact, the author of Roller Girl sent us each galleys of her book. The author is Victoria Jameson, with little notes and little drawings of the...
Decorated envelopes,
which I think we all saved. Mm-hmm. And a little note, and mine says, you know, I believe you have Moppets, you know, who might take an interest in this book. And I said, well, I do. And I had brought it home in a stack and forgotten to give it to her. She's tearing through this book. I have read half of it. It is just a marvelous graphic novel about not only the process of this girl becoming interested in roller derby, but how friendships take different forms and ebb and flow, and you become less of friends with one person and more of friends with another. And this book takes that very seriously, and it's very funny and very charming. As the father of an 11-year-old, I found it very moving. It's a 240-page graphic novel that really moves through this whole story. And what I'm most excited about with it, in addition to it being a wonderful book about a wonderful subject being read by a wonderful girl, is that it is a perfect gateway drug into the movie Whip It, which I have bought on DVD and have been saving for my daughter when I thought she would enjoy it most. And so once she is done reading Roller Girl, I intend to have her go right into the movie Whip It. I love roller derby. I love this book, and I'm delighted to have just happened to have been sent a copy of it at a time when my daughter was interested in it.
Well, that is wonderful. Thank you, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Two things. The first one has about it the air of inevitability. I love the comedian Paul F. Tompkins. I love podcasts. I love the comedian Paul F. Tompkins on podcasts. And Paul F. Tompkins has a new podcast. It is called Spontanean Nation. Names are hard.
Yeah.
And it doesn't need any help from me, from us. It's the number one podcast on iTunes. It's doing great. And it's not a replacement for the late lamented Pod F Tomcast.
Right.
It is comparatively to that show, which was very tightly scripted and really elaborately produced. This is much looser. It starts off with him doing an interview with a friend of his. Then he invites a bunch of improvisers in to riff on topics raised in that first interview. It's very funny. It's very good. Still finding its legs. Only a few episodes out there. It's coming out, I think, every week. So check that out.
Are the friends he's interviewing Ice-T and Andrew Lloyd Webber?
Nope. That's okay. Pod F Tomcat.
Sorry.
Completely different thing. Second thing is the video game Dragon Age Inquisition. This is a role-playing game. I like role-playing games because I like being a wizard who is engaged in the zapping of others. That's what I like about role-playing games. This game came out last year. But, I mean, this series is where you have your character, but you also can invite up to three other characters that you meet along the way into your party. And as a party together, the four of you go and attack and zap things. Now, you control all four of these characters. All four of these characters are you. So as you are fighting a thing, you can switch between them, and everybody has different strengths. So, you know, I hear that, and I think, four times the zapping. Awesome. It also means, however, that it's four times the micromanaging of your inventory and your armor and your weapons and your spells and your health. And that's the thing I'm not crazy about in RPGs is that kind of micromanaging. And there's like some games that benefit from a casual approach, some games that benefit from a hardcore approach, and then some games that benefit from a Rain Man approach.
And right.
This particular game is certainly in that last category. I got very frustrated with the first Dragon Age that I played a few years back because I kept wanting the other party members that I wasn't controlling at the time to just figure stuff out, we're attacking something, and I shouldn't have to tell you and set your default so that when you are at 20% health, you drink a potion of healing. Mm-hmm. You should just do that.
Of course you should.
We couldn't get past this one level, with this one encounter with fire demons, and I couldn't figure out why, and then it turns out that Schmucko, the other wizard, was throwing fireballs at a fire demon, which is like you're throwing Bactine at it, basically. Yeah. You're like tossing him a five-hour energy drink. Here you go. Feel better. So frustrating. So I am at a very early stage in Dragon Age Inquisition. It seems to me that the AI is much smarter this time around. I don't have to do that micromanaging. We're at a very low level. Although I did get a kind of a rude awakening when I was doing the character creation. Nowadays, Linda, when you do character creation in a role-playing game especially, you can kind of create the face right. in a very, very ridiculously detailed way.
Right.
The angle of the ridge of the brow, all that stuff. And at one point, as I was doing this you know, almost half an hour long process, I was on a screen that I swear to God said, nostril depth. And I thought to myself, I don't know if I can gin up the conviction enough to have an opinion about the nostril depth of my character.
Mm-hmm.
And so, what? So that
depends on what he's trying to store up.
Well, that's the thing. I did. By the time it was done,
you think that until you get the nostril depth wrong, you realize it's all wrong.
You must choose.
Well, the way it ended up with, he turned out to be, because I just sort of gave up after a while because I just wanted to start zapping things.
He just wound up with very shallow nostrils.
He actually turned out to be sort of a Ziggy Stardust for reasons that elude me. I don't know what that says. I don't know what that means, but there it is. So we've just started out. That's Dragon Age Inquisition. I'm playing it on the PS4, but it's for a bunch of different consoles and whatnot.
Very good. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Chris Klimek, what is making you happy this week?
Two special venues for watching movies. The Alamo, D.C. is located in Loudoun County, Virginia,
yes, it
as
sure
you know,
is.
Having been there.
Not
it's
DC.
Out by my parents.
Not
but
DC.
In honor of Furious 7, they have a month's worth of vehicular mayhem-oriented programming. So I went out there to see my folks for Easter, and the night before, I saw Duel, a vintage Steven Spielberg joint from before Jaws, originally made for TV, then expanded for theatrical release. It's terrific. It all set in the daytime in... in and around, I don't know, maybe it's Barstow, California. It's somewhere out there in the lonely, lonely desert. There's no darkness. There's only shadow.
Right.
And Dennis Weaver plays this salesman in a car who's tailed by this demonic truck. That's pretty much the whole movie.
Yeah.
It is terrific. And, of course, seen in the most pristine conditions and the very civilized and well-cultivated by people who love and respect movies, Alamo. Easter weekend was the opening weekend for the season of Benji's Drive-In on the opposite Compass Point out in Middle River, Maryland. That one is even about twice as far from D.C., so listeners in Baltimore or Philly, points east, worth the drive for $10 per person admission, less than the cost of a single first-run movie. You can see up to three features. Sometimes they only do two, depending on, you know, how late it gets dark and how long the movies are. But usually for that, you get a family-oriented first feature and then a PG-13 superhero kind of middle and then maybe a horror movie or an adult comedy like Ted at the end. I submit to you that any movie is made better by the presence of lightning bugs.
Yeah.
And this venue is, aside from their fully modern projection system, otherwise untouched by time. It is like stepping into the past. You can get some cola that I think they make there on site. The popcorn is
That's
real popcorn.
Great.
There's cotton candy. You can bring lawn chairs if you don't want to sit there in your car all night. Benji's Drive-In, so great.
Do they show the film strip, like the Let's All Go?
Yes, yes, they do.
I think that's a requirement to drive-in.
Right. Mm-hmm. No, I should have said, not only that, but in
Steven
the...
Steven is salivating over here.
Yes,
he's
I am.
Right.
So I live in Maryland.
I mean, in the same way that when you go to a movie at the Alamo, the pre-show, instead of showing you like cell phone ads or whatever you get at a, you know, a corporate chain movie theater, there is a bit of programming that a real human being has chosen.
Right.
Of like old trailers and like short films related to the feature you're going to see. Benji's does that too. In the middle of the three features that they're showing, sometimes you'll get some just random old trailers. I saw one for Around the World in 80 Days once, the 50s version. And then they'll throw in the trailer for Star Wars or E.T. or, you know, just things like that, along with bizarre old educational films and ads and stuff. It's a lot of fun. If you really love movies, Benji's Drive-In is the best place to see them outside.
That is wonderful. Thank you, Chris Klimek. Okay, so April 18th, New York, I will be covering for NPR the College A Cappella Championships, the national, international Collegiate A Cappella Championships. As those of you who've been listening to this show for a while know, this is a genre that's quite dear to me, that I was once involved in. The opportunity to think about covering this and how best to do it has allowed me to rediscover a series of albums put out by their organization, which is now called Varsity Vocals. You can actually find on Spotify, by the way, a lot of these records. They do yearly compilation albums, which they call Best of College A Cappella. So they're all called Boca, various things. I have at different times owned a whole bunch of these CDs. I owned the run from about the earliest ones in 95, that they were doing in like 95, 96, up through the ones in around 2002. And then I kind of trailed off. But this round of research has taken me back into the archives to listen to some stuff that I have not listened to in quite a number of years that I really, really, really loved. And it has taken me back to the great variety and interest that you actually can find in College A Cappella. And I'm going to start by playing you a clip of something that I had not listened to for a long time, that I forgot how much I loved it until I heard it again.
I sit alone and I watch the clock. I breathe in on the tick. and out on the talk. I can hear your bad feet on the kitchen floor, and I don't have to have these dreams no more. I found someone just to hold me tight. Hold the insomniac all night.
That is the Virginia Gentleman in 1996. And performing Insomniac, originally a Billy Pilgrim song. I fell in love with that off of a longer compilation record, and I always thought of it as the one that just I loved. But I didn't realize until I went back to their, they have a best of the 20 years, they have a kind of a 20-year best of record wrapping up all these, and they put it on there, like a greatest hits album. And I was like, oh, I guess everyone liked this. And then I looked and it said this was their most popular for the next decade. This was their most popular cut. And other groups had transcribed the arrangement and done it themselves. And so that's a very popular one. There are also some of them that are just funny. That is the Stanford Harmonics in 1999 on a compilation called Boca Humor, Wasting Our Parents' Money. And they are doing the Green Day classic Basket Case on pitch pipe. So unlike all of the rest of this, which is singing, that is pitch pipe. And before I leave you from this, I want to play you one more thing. I want you to pay close attention to this one thing. God had a face. What would it look like, and would you want to see in me that you would have to believe things like heaven and Jesus, the saints and all the prophets. That is the University of Pennsylvania Counterparts in 1998. The guy who is the soloist there was very important to that group. They went to the championships. They were very prominent. His name was John Stevens. And later he changed his name to John Legend. What if God was one of us? Just a man like one of us. Just a stranger on the bus trying to make his way home. So that's who that was.
Mm-hmm.
That was your old pal.
Thank you, Paul Harvey.
John Legend. John Legend singing with the University of Pennsylvania Counterparts. And so I have been very much enjoying exploring these records again. And it's been a long time since I listened to them. And if you are going to be at this competition, or especially in this competition, on April 18th, I will see you in New York. And that is what is making me happy this week.
Wow.
You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon. You can follow Chris at CT Klimek. That's K-L-I-M-E-K. You can follow the show at NPR PCHH and our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. That's R-E-E-D-Y. You can follow our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.